All right, if everybody could take their seats and quiet down, we'll start. Everybody in the crowd, if you could take your seats and quiet down. We'll bring the public safety policy and finance to order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Here.
Gauthier.
Tell me to just go for it.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson. Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
I'm here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Present.
Smith.
Here.
Okay, members, entertain a motion to approve the minutes from February 15th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hilty moves the minutes from February 15th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Okay, folks, today we're going to start out with Representative Smith Bill, House File 370.
I didn't see that it's kept it on.
That's right, I understand that.
Sorry.
Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would. House File 370, I would move the bill. And after testimony, I would ask that the chair lay it over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill.
Okay, Representative Smith moves his bill for possible inclusion. And Representative Smith, go ahead and however you'd like to start.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. I'm going to just briefly tell you that this bill amends provision currently in statute relating to youth intervention program grants. The intent of the youth intervention program is to provide ongoing stable funding to community-based early intervention programs for youth, contingent upon some local matching money. I'm going to ask Mr. Scott Beatty, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Program Association, to walk through the bill, tell you what it does, and then we have four testifiers after that. Hopefully within 20 minutes or so we can be done.
Okay, Representative Smith, thank you. And Mr. Beatty, go ahead, state your name and title, and begin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Beatty, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association. And I'm here today representing over 100 community-based early intervention programs around the state, but really to focus on a program that is funded through the state of Minnesota, partially funded through the state of Minnesota, called the Youth Intervention Program, and in this particular case, House File 370. What 370 does is really asks that the program funding continue at the same level that it currently is today. And we have a PowerPoint up here. We've had, unfortunately, we've had a little technical difficulty getting this thing going here, but are we ready? But anyway, let me just tell you a little bit about the Youth Intervention Program and what it's all about. It's a 35-year-old partnership between the state of Minnesota and the local communities that are providing these early intervention programs. The programs use mentoring, counseling, diversion, restorative justice, restitution, community mediation, and other kind of programs to work with these kids right when they're starting to get in trouble. The whole concept of this program is to get these kids when they're just starting to make some mistakes and to work with them and to keep them on the right path. Do you have this thing up there? No. The administration of the program is administered through the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs. It serves about 17,000 kids a year on average and requires a 2-to-1 community match for every dollar provided by the state. The program, you know, we've really had a great relationship with the Office of Justice Programs with this. We've worked on, you know, with them administering the program. We worked on many, many issues related to juvenile justice and the early intervention program with them, and have collaborated on some things. And I will let you know what those things are as we move through this this presentation. The Youth Intervention Program is currently funded at $1.6 million, which funds 57 community-based agencies around the state.
Mr. Beattie?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you, but members, you have the PowerPoint presentation in your pack if you want to open it up and follow along until we get our technical difficulties fixed. Go ahead, Mr. Beattie.
Yeah, we'd be on page 4 of your PowerPoint presentation right now. Anyway, the program was funded a couple years ago at $2.4 million, which funded 67 organizations. And 2 years ago, it lost $750,000. And coincidentally, it also lost, we lost 10 programs being funded. Even if the program remains funded at the base, which is $1.6 million a year, these 57 programs will probably lose some additional funding because the state, well, actually put Public Safety Fund a couple years ago was some additional funding to put into this, and that funding probably, it was about $250,000, and that funding probably won't be available in this particular upcoming biennium. YPA did a survey a few years ago trying to find out where exactly these programs are and what programs, areas of the state where we think there could be additional programs, and if you turn to the next slide, you'll see where the map, there's a map there that shows where the programs currently are. There's also arrows next to programs that have lost funding, the 10 programs that lost funding in the last go-around. And if you look, you'll see the white areas of that map. Those are areas that really don't have these kind of programs, so these kids really aren't really getting those services, or if there are services there, they're not funded through the Youth Intervention Program, and more than likely those organizations are struggling for funding. In 2007, Paul Anton, chief economist for Wilder Research at the time, and Dr. Judy Temple, the economist at the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute, conducted an extensive SROI research project on Minnesota's youth intervention program, on this particular program. And what it found, you know, and these are one of those things where you really don't know what's going to happen when somebody does an SROI research on a program like this. We were pretty sure that it was going to turn out okay, but the reality is we weren't sure. But what happened was is they came out and found out that for every dollar invested in this program, there's a $4.89 return. And that's using what they call a comprehensive program. And if you use the state, the matching dollars that each program puts into it, the two for one, it actually is a return on investment of $14.68. The next slide I threw in because it shows the bullseye slide, which really shows how much these economists found out that this program cost per child. And what this did per year is what it did is it used rent, all the things that are involved in an agency to come up with a calculated cost. But the one thing I do want to point out is if you take just the youth intervention funding, the 1.6, and you add the community dollars, which ends up being two times that, added on to the 1.6, and you divide that by the number of youth being served, it comes to less than $500 per kid when you look at the state-funded and the community dollars funded. The next slide on page 8, we just talk about that there's a lot of research out there that consistently shows that charging, adjudicating, and incarcerating youth does cost significantly more dollars to the state than community-based funding, which this program happens to be. And doesn't always result in increased public safety. The next slide, unfortunately, is kind of small on your...
It's up.
Thank you.
Yay. Thank you, technical man.
Thank you, technical guys. This particular slide I wanted to show you because it's an invoice that was put together by a juvenile justice group on a research that Mark Cohen at Vanderbilt University conducted quite a few years ago. So even if you brought this over in today's dollars, I think it would be more than this. But what this does is it shows how much it costs society for a youth that quits school and takes up a life of crime and drugs, which is a fairly common scenario for a kid that does quit school. And as you can see, the cost is between $1.7 and $2.3 million, so an average of about $2 million in costs for every one of these kids that ends up, and this is over the life of the kid. But the one thing I did want to point out with this, though, are the victim costs, which are you and me and things that happen, and it ends up being well over $1 million in victim costs over the life of this child into youth. The next slide is outcomes, and I was saying something earlier about the relationship that we have and what the OJP has with the grantees, and we've been working with them for the last few years to come up with really excellent outcomes that we can really show the public how this works. We now have the SROI, and now we've got really good outcomes. We've always been able to track recidivism rates fairly well. Those are kids that come in because it was a legal issue, and we find out whether they've had re-involvement in the legal system. But it was really hard because these programs are a little different. Each one are a little different. They're all early intervention programs, but they're all just a little different. It was really hard to kind of come up with some good outcomes. So what OJP did is they're using the Minnesota Student Survey, and they devised a great tool that's statistically valid using questions from the Minnesota Student Survey that are pre and post test for each one of these kids that are going through the program. And these are just some of the outcomes that are being reported from 2010. So I'll just kind of let you kind of take a look at some of these, but as you can see, there's all sorts of in very important outcomes that we think kids need to go through. In addition, I wanted to point out that there was also 174 youth that paid over $20,000 in restitution, and 2,269 youth performed over 27,000 hours of community service. So a lot of these kids in these programs are giving back to their community. In 2010, the Office of Justice Programs conducted a stakeholder survey to take a look at where they wanted to focus their crime prevention and their funding and what their priorities would be. And their stakeholders, who they surveyed, were grantees, law enforcement, county attorneys, court administrators, state partners, those folks. And they surveyed 634 respondents, and you can see there who they were. 12% of them were actually community members, parents, and youth. And the next slide, I think, shows where those priorities really are. And they really came in, as you can see, high. The 31% felt that prevention and education programs should be one of the top priorities. And the youth intervention program happens to fall under that category. Now, the next slide, actually, they got into, you know, asking questions like, where do you think, what programs would have the best impact on public safety? And as you can see, 75% of the folks felt that youth intervention programs would have the best impact, potential impact, on public safety. This next slide I thought was kind of interesting. I saw this back in January in the Washington Post, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Right on Crime campaign, but Newt Gingrich and a guy named Pat Nolan. And what I found out about Pat Nolan, I really didn't know who he was when I read this article, but I did find out that Pat was in the California legislature, and I think he got he ended up getting convicted of some accepting some illegal contributions, and he ended up in prison. And through that experience, he kind of came out and really felt like there was a lot of potential for reform in prisons. And so this Right on Crime campaign, which I guess I'm, if you're interested in looking this up, it's a fairly good, I think, campaign going on to look at how states can save money by keeping people out of prisons. And of course, we think that the Youth Intervention Program does a great job of that. If you want to see that article, you could Google both these guys' names and it would come up. So the next slide I wanted to show you is I happen to watch Almanac every week, and back in January your House Speaker Zellers was on Almanac, and I thought one of the things he had to say was very revealing, because they asked Speaker Zellers, you know, what are you going to be looking, you know, at within the state budget? And luckily I have DVR, so I was kind of able to go back and write this down. But I thought what he said was very profound. What did we spend the money on? Did we get value out of it? Did it change a Minnesotan's life for the better? And is it money well spent? And I think on the Youth Intervention Program, we can say positively, yes, we have a great social return on investment, and we know we're keeping at least 80% of the kids from progressing or getting into the juvenile justice system. So it's working. We know it's working, and I think we can say positively that it's a great program and a great, what I would consider, a great public safety and crime prevention tool. Now, a little bit more about the bill, because we're not just asking to keep the funding the same. There's also some policy issues that I want to talk to you about. The first one raises the limit on what the amount the grantees can get. Currently, the grantees range from getting $10,000 from the state up to $40,000. That's the max anybody's getting. The current limit says $50,000. We thought, we, as long as we were in here, we would hopefully someday we're going to get this, the increase, and there would be more funding, and it would allow these programs to get up to $75,000. There's also a provision in there that increases the percent that YIPA gets, because YIPA provides collaboration and training to the grantees and other youth service providers. And right now, quite frankly, it's real easy with the budget that the counties and cities and schools have, rather than cut services and cut staff, they tend to cut their professional development programs. And what we're trying to do, and we think it's very important to maintain professional development at a high quality level, so that these youth service providers are doing a great job with these kids. They're identifying what's going on with them, and they're making sure they get the right services. So we want to maintain a very high quality professional development service for these grantees. So that's the increase in that. The other thing that we've got is, and this may happen, is if a program ends up folding because of budget cuts or constraints, what this allows, the language allows for, is that rather than have that funding go back to the general fund, it would allow public safety to be able to put that money back into the youth intervention program. And last but not least, the other policy issue is if two organizations, YIP-funded organizations, merge, it would allow them, if they wanted to keep both youth intervention programs and if public safety agrees that these programs will be maintained as they said they would do it and maintain those two programs, that that funding could carry over to that one organization. So to end, let me just say one thing. All kids change, okay? Some for the better, some for the worse. Youth intervention programs, is a sound crime prevention and early intervention program that is here to help our youth change for the better. And that's really what we're doing. And we do that through developing relationships with these kids, because relationships are the key. That's why you get mentors and counselors and coaches and all these kind of people that are working with these kids, because we know that it's those relationships that make a difference. Now, today we've got a few testifiers to help us with this. And and the first testifier we've got up is Jim Backstrom, a Dakota County attorney. And I'll let Jim get up and speak, and then I'll introduce the others as we go forward. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Mr. Backstrom. You know the drill, so
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County attorney. It is a privilege to be here this morning to speak in support of the Youth Intervention Program Association and their need for funding. I am a strong believer in the need to keep our community safe, obviously, and to enforce our laws, but I have long believed that the single most important thing we can do to reduce crime in our society is to invest time, energy, and resources into our nation's children. I think that is one of the most important things that we can do as a society to prevent crime and to protect the health and safety of youth in our country. I have worked for many years at a variety of groups, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, where I chaired the Juvenile Justice Committee for a number of years. I also am a board member of the National District Attorneys Association and chaired the Juvenile Justice Committee for that organization for 13 years as well. I've worked very hard on dealing with juvenile crime issues across our country. I'm passing out an article you can read at your leisure that I wrote some time ago, focusing on what we can do to prevent the juvenile crime issues that we have in our country. And as I mentioned in that article, and I'm not going to sit here and read it to you today, but as I mentioned there, I do believe that investing in our children in meaningful ways, such as is provided through the Youth Intervention Program Association programs, really does make a difference. We need to focus on at-risk kids. We need to get these kids into the types of programs that they need to address their underlying problems, whether it's a chemical dependency issue, whether it's violence-related issues, or they have come out of a family situation that's traumatic and they need some help and leadership and guidance, I should say, to get them back on the right track and away from committing crimes. And to provide positive mentoring relationships with adults and youth alike. And that's what the Youth Intervention Program Association does through these efforts each and every day. These programs make a difference. As Scott B. has indicated to you in his presentation, they do save money in the long run. And I'm here to tell you, as a law enforcement professional that's been working in our community in Dakota County for the past 34 years, 24 as the county attorney, that these programs do make a difference in terms of reducing crime and protecting our children. So I just wanted to offer my support for this, and I know your time is short, but if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, the next individual is the City of Cottage Grove Director of Public Safety, Chief Craig Woolery. And after him, we have two others.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Chief Woolery. Go ahead with your name and title and proceed. Thank you.
Craig Woolery, Director of Public Safety, City of Cottage Grove. I'd just like to speak on behalf and support of the youth intervention on the street level for law enforcement, what it means to us. 28 years I've been with the city. We've used primary diversions for typical youth offenses, from theft, chemicals, fire, assaults, everything else, and it does make a difference. We primarily have worked at a long relationship with Youth Service Bureau, Inc. A number of agencies in Washington County use the same service for primary diversions. But the good thing about the what the cops see is that it is a data-driven. It's the kids are held accountable. They're offered an opportunity to repair damages that are done, meet victims, and deal with other people. I know just by our officers sending the last year alone, the 500-some kids we sent off to diversion, and these are simple offenses from going down to Kohl's and taking some clothing or other things. It's the first offense where they typically be in the courts and maybe wait a year before they were held accountable. They met with the victors, the offending persons, but they also were assigned community service, other things that got involved with the family as well. Probably saved our department alone just over $100,000 just in officer overtime from being in court, and that's the time officers could be back on the street doing their jobs. These intervention programs are adaptable. We see a lot more involvement with the schools. The schools have resource issues, and we work on with or our Youth Service Bureau works with children on keeping them in school versus suspension, on behavioral or assaultive issues. They also, I could talk about a program we had a couple years ago at our local library. Right adjacent, just by proximity, is a multifamily housing unit. A lot of the kids that come home after school are latchkey kids. They have minimal things at home, and where they would tend to gravitate to would be the library, primarily to use the internet, things like that. But they had some core behavioral issues. And what happened was they just through behaviors, the police were called, and the same thing happened day in, day out. We'd come, we'd disperse, and we'd move the kids on. The librarians and the staff would be frustrated because the same behaviors continued day after day. Our local Youth Service Bureau became involved after we made a call to them after a few months, and they started what they call the Library Leaders Program. They took a few core talented youth, got involved in behavioral issues, taught other kids how to behave in a public facility, and I can say our call load went down to nothing just because of that. We can spend our time better places, but the better part of that is now you have a core group of kids that have a place to be after school that's safe, it's a productive environment, and it really worked. So I just want to speak on behalf of law enforcement that it does make a difference on what these intervention programs do. And we do count on them. We work closely with our county prosecutors, with the courts. They all have helped us streamline our process, so when we have a youth that's offended, they get held accountable right away, and it works for everybody across the board. So thank you for allowing me to speak this morning.
Thank you very much, Chief Fuller. I appreciate it. Do you want to just proceed or take questions now, Reverend?
Mr. Chairman, let's hit the next two, if we can. The next individual, second to the last individual, is Paul Ramsour, Supervisor, Life Transitions Program.
Good morning, Chairperson, Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Ramsour. Go ahead and state your name and title and begin.
My name is Paul Ramsour. I supervise the Youth Intervention Program at Youth Link in Minneapolis. Our program is a school-based intervention program. In other words, social workers identify youth they're in need and refer them to our agency. These are high school students that have been identified as homeless and highly mobile, who are at risk of dropping out of school. And as you know, there's a direct correlation between the dropout rate and incarceration. It's the youth intervention, it's the intervention service that makes it possible for other services to happen. It all starts with the intervention. And that's the case with T. T was referred by a social worker because she was homeless and couch hopping from place to place. Her mother had moved back to Florida and left her here in Minnesota by herself. The intervention was early in her situation, and because of that, the following services were able to be delivered. She was a change in guardianship because of a child protection case that revealed abuse by her mother. She was made an application to a supportive housing program. She was reassigned to a new school that had special education testing. She was involved in independent living skills classes and tutoring in the out-of-school time. She was enrolled in a job training program. She received counseling and medical referrals due to the trauma associated with her mother. She enrolled in general assistance for minors. She had access to emergency clothing closets and emergency food shelf. All of these services were made possible because of the funding for early intervention services, because the case manager who works on her case is directly funded by the YIP grant that Youth Link receives. Many times intervention service staff are the first people to get involved and look beneath the surface to find out what's going on in the life of a young person who's in crisis. Whether that crisis is homelessness, or drug abuse, or juvenile justice involvement, or truancy. Youth intervention service workers are on the front lines. They interview families. They make home visits. They assign mentors. They advocate at school and in court. They are often providing transportation to school and other services, making appointments and arranging meetings with parents and other service providers. And in the process of doing all of this, they're talking to kids. They're building rapport, they're asking questions, listening to stories, and piecing together how kids get into these circumstances from the beginning. And after that, they understand how they got there. They proceed to put together the necessary plans and supports and resources that will make huge positive changes in the life of a youth. All of these programs that are funded by the Youth Intervention Program Grant provide these types of interventions. The entire process of help and support starts when someone in the life of a child in crisis recognizes the program and makes a referral to get someone involved. And it doesn't matter how it gets started. Whether it's a need for a mentor or a chemical dependency assessment, a referral to a counselor, or an after-school tutoring program, or a culturally specific out-of-school time experience, or a mediation or restorative justice process, the intervention has started and will continue to make an impact long after the initial reason has ended. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. A truancy intervention leads to a tutoring program, which leads to an independent living skills program, which leads to a job readiness program, which leads to an internship, which leads to a summer job program, which leads to advocacy for graduation, which leads to a scholarship program, which leads to a post-secondary enrollment, which leads to continuing employment, and all of that starts from a simple truancy intervention that's funded by this grant. It really does work exactly this way. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have one last individual testifying in favor of the bill, a student who has received under this program, Giovanni Alvarado, a student.
Good morning, Mr. Alvarado. Go ahead and state your name and begin with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
My name is Giovanni Alvarado. I'm currently a junior at St. James High School in St. James, Minnesota. Chairman Cornish, I'm sure you're familiar with St. James.
Yeah.
Okay. Those who have not visited or St. James, we're a rural community of 5,600 people. We're located 35 miles west of Mankato. In addition, we're all agriculture based, and we have small business and several food processing plants. Unlike many neighboring school districts, we have a strong diversity, and our elementary school features a demographic of over 15 Latinos, or 50% Latino. We all work hard together in our school and community to succeed. My personal story is now of success. I'm an honor roll student. I participate in football, wrestling, track. In addition to that, I'm part of the Youth Council, Student Council, Hispanic Youth Leaders Team Up, serve as a peer educator in the NABLE program, and was chosen as a team leader for a Courage Retreat for 7th graders. All the positive activities that have helped me make better choices in my life, and I, in turn, have tried to help others choose the right path. My future goals include competing in football in college, and just like Representative Marilyn Smith and this community, I hope to be a lawyer one day. With that said, my story was not always a success. My father was never part of my life, so it was just me, my mother, 5 brothers, and 1 sister. I did not always make the right choices, and often ran into trouble in school. There were a lot of fights in the junior high. I always seemed like I was mad at other people, and then I always put school off. My attitude affected my efforts in school, and then I was headed in the wrong direction. My oldest brother traveled in the same path, but then the youth intervention program brought him towards school activities and soon had positive influence in his life where there were none before. He used those opportunities and grants to graduate from St. James High School, graduate from Ridgewater Community College, and now is at SMSU in Marshall, taking coursework to become a physical therapist. Just I followed the similar path of trouble in my early years, I changed direction and have high goals just like my brother and everybody else. I took hard work and good people who cared, and throughout the funding through the Youth Intervention Program, I would have to have been very hard without it. I used other sources. I used to work at a furniture store. And then last summer, I wanted to go to a football camp at SMSU. And then a coach of mine helped me find money by helping out a farmer. And then that farmer had me up on a loader on a tractor with a chainsaw. It made me nervous because the farmer only had one arm and didn't exactly say how that happened. There are many ways to think or work outside of school without the intervention programs, but they're not nearly as stable, or in this case, we're safe. The Youth Intervention Program was instrumental for my success, and I urge you to support the bill as it stands and provide an ongoing, stable funding source for the community-based early intervention programs for the youth as the bill currently stands. I know Minnesota is facing a historical deficit, and we all share a difficult decision you must make, but those decisions should take into action more than just a dollar amount, in case the decision can have a tremendous impact on the future of many youth in Minnesota, just like it did mine. There's a chance I could have made it without the help and provide assistance there that were more important people. When I look at the part of the Youth Intervention Program, it did not create a standalone function, but rather a function where it formed a synergy with already existing programs and resources. It is a very effective way to use funding, and it makes previous investments of state money even more valuable. When I look at sports I'm involved in so far, the Youth Intervention Program has helped me with that, because each sport for each season is $55, and so far I've used $110 of that, and it helped me take part in 9 football games and 25 wrestling matches so far this year. This highly effective process means $110 investment was enable me to participate in approximately 450 hours of building positive relationships, increasing life skills that helped me succeed in college and later in life. I work hard. I have to work hard. I don't want anybody doing something for me that I couldn't do myself. I needed the help of the Youth Intervention Program. My family needed it. We have also worked very hard to make good on the investment. I'm only one before you today, but I'm surrounded by many at my school and community. Just I have learned that my hard work as a teammate helps the larger team succeed. An important part played by the Youth Intervention Program helps the larger systems and schools and communities succeed. I thank you for your time, and just sincerely urge you to consider the support of the House File 370 to continue providing important funding in youth programs to continue effectively helping children heading in trouble to the positive direction. Thank you for your support.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Alvarado. It's always nice to see a good outcome out of a successful program. Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to close at this point if there's no questions of any of the testifiers.
Questions? Representative Leidiger, Woodward, followed by Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most of my questions were actually answered by Mr. Ramzur, which really laid out how this program works, but I had one additional question, and that is a lot of these grants that I can see through the your presentation, they're small. I mean, they seem like they're $15,000 here, $20,000 there. Do they go, and you may have said it, I probably missed it, who administers those grants? Like, is it Youth Link? or do a lot of them also go directly to police departments, or can you tell me who they actually go to, what the majority of them?
Mr. Beattie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, what happens is that it's administered through the Department of Public Safety. These grants are then doled out to these particular agencies. And so, like YouthLink, for instance, would get their $40,000. They have to find that matching dollars in their community. So they'll go to their community and say, we have this opportunity to get this amount of money if you come up with $2 for every dollar. So each one of these, most of these are community-based organizations that are doing it. When you get out into greater Minnesota, like Moorhead, it's the police department that's doing it there. Some of them are court services because they don't have, like in the Twin Cities, they don't have the luxury of having these youth service agencies all over. So it has to be done kind of by different organizations depending on the community and the size of the community usually.
Thank you.
Does that answer
your question? That does answer the question. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Woodard and Grunhagen, and then keep in mind we have another bill and a lengthy presentation by probation yet today. So
I just have a quick remark, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And I usually pride myself on really vetting out bills that I co-author. But I had no idea until Mr. Alvarado's testimony that we are actually training future lawyers. So I apologize that I was not aware of that. But I encourage the members to get past any issues they may have with lawyers and please support this bill. And Mr. Alvarado, great testimony. I encourage you to find a productive line of work as opposed to being a lawyer at some point. So thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Just kidding. No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Director Beattie. Just a compliment on your presentation. One of the things I like to see is objective data, and you did an excellent job of providing that and then breaking the numbers down in an understandable form. And so I really appreciate that. Just one other quick question on the fiscal note. So are we, and this is just to maybe Representative Smith, are we coming up with that additional money by reducing something else, or is it just additional expenditure?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask our
Fiscal Assistant
Man Carter to respond.
Go ahead.
Mr. Carter, yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. Basically, this is what the funding they're receiving right now. It's the base funding. So in other words, they're not asking for an increase or anything else. It's just to keep the existing funding going.
Mr. Chairman, do you have any opposition testimony? If not, I'll proceed to close.
Well, let's see. Representative McDonald had one question.
Sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. In regards to a school police liaison, I know that school districts and cities who have done this are struggling to find the funding. Does this mechanism, do some of these monies allow for school districts and cities to share in the grant so we can put a police officer in the schools? I'll just preface that with, originally I was against this when I was the mayor of Delano, but after having a police officer in the school, one that's great with students, developed great friendships, and crime and misbehavior went down considerably in the community. So does this allow for that?
Thank you. Mr. Beattie or Representative?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, definitely. There are already programs that do that, like down in Austin, for instance. This program helps fund the police liaison officer there, and so they're working together with the schools to do that. So yes, it does, and it can. And like I said before, we're trying to increase this so every kid in the state has access to these kind of programs, and we are open to those kind of collaborative type of things that go on to this. So yes.
Okay, thank you. If there are any opposition in the crowd, to testify in opposition, seeing none, Representative Smith, you'd like to make a closing remark.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would. I want to thank all the testifiers today. There's two reasons that I've supported the YIPA funding for as long as I've been here, and I think there's the same reasons that this legislature does. The second reason And by the way, the short answer to Representative Leidiger is the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs administers the funds, and this committee has oversight of every dollar that goes through that office. The two reasons, the second reason is this is cost effective. For every dollar or so that the state spends on the intervention programs, it saves lots of dollars as opposed to spending it in juvenile correctional facilities, prosecutions, residential treatment, excuse me, etc. But the first reasons are that it allows people like Giovanni to, when they're having difficulty or committing a first crime, it allows them to be turned around and to live a productive life rather than a destructive one. So I'd close on that note and ask you to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay, seeing no more comments, thank you very much, Representative. Yes, Mr. Beattie.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one more comment. I do want to thank all the people that came today. I know there's a lot of kids and youth that came from all over the state today to be a part of this and the testifiers. So thank you very much, everybody, for coming, and really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
And and we'll hold the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ready?
I didn't see that, sorry.
No, that's all right. They told me they're going to be here 10 to 4 o'clock.
How you doing?
And they
They're gone.
Right.
They're gone.
Oh, are we?
The page is gone. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Next up is Representative Kelly with House File 387. And Representative Kelly, how would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would request that remove House File 387, request that it pass and be re-referred to Committee on Transportation, please.
Okay. Representative Kelly, you heard the motion that he moves his bill. House File 387 recommended to pass and re-referred to the Transportation Committee. All right, Mr. Kelly, Representative Kelly, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If I could use Representative Smith's bill and presentation as kind of a segue into this. We all know that kids make mistakes. The Youth Intervention Program is a way of using a different program and having a positive effect with positive outcomes. And unfortunately, we all know that adults make mistakes as well. One of these things that we are trying to do, we have a problem in this state where approximately any time over 500,000 people are driving without a license. And House File 387 simply is going to extend a pilot program which we all can claim success on. Because what the pilot program did was allow a different avenue of intervention into this problem. And it allowed for these people who have had either a suspended license or a revoked license, set them on a new path so that they could get reinstated with their license, get back to work, and have an avenue of paying their fines in such a way that they can complete the process. And the best part of this is that this is a public-private partnership. It was something that we as a public entity in government were not doing very well. We were not getting licenses back. We were not collecting the fines. And in stepped the reinstatement diversion pilot program. So what we're asking for today is simply an extension of the program to 2013. I think the best way for you to understand the program is through an example, and I've asked Mr. Atkinson, who is the CEO and President of Financial Crime Services, to walk us through that.
Sir, I can go ahead and talk about 387. Keep in mind that this is a very successful program. It holds no fiscal costs. It's just a reinstatement. And if you could just keep your testimony fairly short, that it's not a controversial bill. So thank you much, and go ahead, sir.
Great. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for having me here. Again, my name is Scott Atkinson. I am the CEO and president of Financial Crime Services and Divergent Solutions. I'm just going to, I'd like to just give you just an overview of how an individual comes into our program. And there are, the starting point of an individual coming to our program is receiving a driving after revocation or driving after suspension citation. Once they receive the citation, we have worked with local law enforcement in our pilot cities that actually hand out what we call an orange card that allows a person to contact the program. And by the way, we're the third-party management company with the program for this program. And allows the individual to contact us so that we can explain the program and how we can support them in getting their license reinstated. We have two ways of doing it. One is through law enforcement, handing out what we call an orange card. The other one is through what we call our friends and family program. And that's where we have helped individuals already, and there are other individuals that are holding these citations that have not paid for them that they can call up and we can see if we can support them. After an individual calls us and then we qualify that individual on our end as specified by the program, we then send that individual's information off to Department of Vehicle Services, who do a check on their licensing and decide whether that person can be qualified to come into the program or not. Our second line of checks is then that individual, after Department of Vehicle Services, goes over to the City of St. Paul Attorney's Office. Jessica McConaughey, who is on my right here, will also do a background check on this person to make sure that we will allow them into the program to get relicensed back. After all these individual checks are done, then it comes back to us, and that's when we make contact with the individual. We review the criteria and the suspension, reason for the suspension. We also review the amount of citations that are owed and the monies that are owed by this individual to the state of Minnesota because of the citations that they have received. They then have to agree to be set up on a payment plan. They have to show us proof of insurance that they are getting insuring themselves and their vehicles. And then they have to attend with a four-hour life skills class that we have assembled and we keep creating on a regular basis to help these individuals. The life skills class goes through how to drive properly, how to maintain your vehicles. We go through financial, how to balance your financials, and it's just a host of information that we go through. It's about a 4 to 4.5 hour class that they take. After that is done, then we have the requirements that they have that are stated by the state of Minnesota again to reissue a driver's license or make them valid for driving, is what it is. So they would have to go through possibly any type of testing that's required by state and or anything else that DVS deems that they have to follow. Once we get them set up, we do put them on a payment plan. We do have, are allowed to set a payment plan up for 18 months because the idea is to keep them valid driving, but also make sure that they are affordable, that they can actually pay the citations off. And then we keep in contact with them monthly. So every month we're in contact with them because they're on our payment plan. So we're usually in a discussion or whatever with these individuals. Could be bi-monthly if they're paying bi-monthly, but we try to keep contact at least once a month. And that's kind of like the overview of how we manage the program and keep in contact with the individuals that have asked for assistance in getting valid again for driving.
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson. And next testifier?
Yep, or Mr. Chair, I should say that right now in the pilot program, the cities of Duluth, St. Paul, South St. Paul, West St. Paul, and Invergrove Heights are currently in the program. This program has had a 77% success rate. It's fantastic. It has returned close to $500,000 back to these cities. And Jessica McConaughey from is an assistant St. Paul city attorney.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Jessica McConaughey. I'm an assistant St. Paul city attorney. I'm here today with Sarah Gruing from my office, who is the city attorney. We are here today on behalf of the pilot cities that Representative Kelly just explained to you, on behalf of Duluth, Invergrove Heights, South St. Paul, West St. Paul. Also, today we are here on behalf of the Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, and I don't see any representatives here today, but they are also an important key factor, an important partner in this program. Also, not present here today, but cities who have been deemed eligible by the Commissioner of Public Safety to participate, the cities of Minneapolis, Bloomington, Maplewood, and cities of Asante. I know that everyone here is very familiar with the program, and I am at this point going to just say that on behalf of all of the pilot cities, as well as the cities who have just come on board, as well as the Department of Vehicle Services, we do ask this committee to pass it here today. And I am just going to sit back, and if there are any questions, I can answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I guess we do have somebody from Driver and Vehicle Services here today. I don't think they really want to testify, but they're here. All right, Representative Kelly, any questions so far? Representative Leidiger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This seems like a very successful program. Couldn't this be expanded to the entire state? And what would we have to do to that? I mean, it's a pilot program right now, I understand, and they are bringing on additional cities. But with this kind of data coming in, this kind of success rate, can this be expanded? And I don't know really who should answer that question. Maybe Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Leidiger, I will let Mr. Atkinson speak to this just briefly, but I believe the one thing the bill will do is expand it or allow the Commissioner of Public Safety to expand it to counties, so we will do that, but Mr. Atkinson could speak to that briefly.
Mr. Atkinson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Leidiger, we're asking for the pilot to be expanded because we don't think we're ready to expand it throughout the state. Because of the different bumps in the road that we find with working with these individuals. I'll give you a couple examples. One example is we work with individuals that have licensing problems in many other states, and we have to clean that licensing problem up for those other states with these individuals before we can get them licensed or into the program in the state of Minnesota. We do have some other federal regulations that have come about within the last couple months, I believe, that we have to implement into our process that we have not implemented. When we get ready and we're comfortable with the program, basically what we want to do is, when it is allowed to go statewide, we want to make sure that we can help the individual and not have a roadblock at that point in time and just frustrate a lot of people. So we want to make sure that we have this program running as smooth as possible. We are working with some other agencies within the state right now, and we want to bring them in with us to support the individuals, such as Port Administration and the Department of Revenue. And because we've only had that short period of time, right now we think we just need a little more time so we can make sure that everybody's working together.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I agree, this is a great program, non-controversial. If we were able to kind of take this concept and move it to other programs, I had a question about how Diversion Solutions stays in business. I mean, is this a for-profit, or how is this funded for your management purposes?
Mr. Atkinson?
Chairman Cornish, representative. We are funded by the individual. So basically the fee to participate in this program is $300. And what happens in this program is that when you receive a DAR, driving after revocation, driving after suspension, that citation is $280. So we set up the program with the pilot cities that an individual comes in, will pay the $300 fee, in which, by the way, that's under the payment plan. That's not up front at all. We still put it under the payment plan. And if they successfully complete the program, the city attorney will forgive or dismiss that citation of $280. So the actual cost and value for that person is $20 for the program. We are taking full responsibility on ourselves to create our income. And we have to be very successful with that individual to get the money.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Seeing no more questions, Representative Kelly, thank you for your testimony. And would you like to restate your motion? Any opposition in the crowd? Okay, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will renew my Motion to move House File 387 refer to Committee on Transportation.
Okay, the motion is recommend to pass and move to the Transportation Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If we could have our probation folks move right down. Members, we're going to have a probation system overview here today, and called in various people from around the state and my hometown area. And keep in mind that these folks are the experts, and there's virtually no question that they can't answer, and we expect to find a complete solution to the probation system today. Okay, folks, you know, you've got quite a job ahead of you here, but what we're hoping to do today is Minnesota's probation system is kind of complex compared to some other states, and it's a different tiered system, and we're wanted to get folks together to see if there's a possibility. One of the things we're thinking about is a seamless a system where everybody comes under one group and a lot less complicated. So who would like to start first? To state your name and title and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Roy. I'm the new Department of Corrections Commissioner, and it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
Thank you for being here, sir.
Taken a while to get here, and I have missed some crucial meetings already, and I'm glad I'm sitting in this chair at this time.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and we've already seen your face a lot more than a lot of agency heads in the past, so it's thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I need to make a couple comments to begin with here. This is a very complex system, and you will hear an alphabet of descriptions, and it's no surprise to you folks that have been on this committee that there tends to be a lot of confusion around the delivery systems that are provided in the state of Minnesota. By viewing your committee work the past couple of weeks, it's clear to me that you folks are really committed to criminal justice, public safety. I know on both sides of the world here, you've expressed a lot of passion on certain subject areas. And I hope your passion continues in support of community-based corrections. Prior to becoming Commissioner of Corrections, and for the previous 36 years of my professional life, I was engaged in probation parole work. My last duty as a Community Corrections Act director in Duluth in the five-county region of the Arrowhead. And I'm very cognizant of the time, Mr. Chair, that we have here, and there's some very qualified people behind me that will make some comments, so I'm going to abbreviate my presentation and explain as best I can initially the three delivery systems. But prior to doing that, I think it's important that we come to agreement on some description of what we're talking about. Probation and parole sometimes are used synonymously. They are very different, but the departments that are sitting behind me in our department, we work with both probation and parole cases. Probation is a status, it's a sentencing status, fresh out of court. And as a part of those probation sentences, there can be special conditions, many different special conditions, including incarceration in local facilities. It is the most common disposition that judges have available to them. And when you see the numbers, I think you will be amazed at how many people in our fine state are currently under a probation status. Parole is the status that Minnesota prisoners fall under once they are released from our corrections facilities. In Minnesota, we call parole supervised release, but parole is the generic description. One-third of this prison sentence, the last one-third of a prison sentence, is served on parole. So when we discuss the services under community, these three delivery systems, hopefully that helps to your in your vision of what we're discussing here. Probation also has many functions, and probation provides a sanction to the courts. It is the most common sanction. We provide incapacitation to offenders who need to get off the street. There are many offenders. When they are sentenced, their life is in such disarray that we have to take them off the street. They have to go into local facilities, treatment. They just can't exist amongst us. We hope that probation sentences have some deterrent effect, that future criminals look at what happens to other people they know, and that there is a reasonable expectation that what we do deters crime. And of course, the most important function that probation parole serves is that of a word that's existed for a long time called rehabilitation. And I know that in the past that word has not always been music to people's ears, but we really hope that the people we work with on probation and parole become changed individuals and are improved by our involvement with them. In your packet, you have a backgrounder report that looks similar to this. And on the map on the back is the geographic description of the services and the way our correctional system delivers services. The Department of Corrections, from the first slide up here, 28 counties where we do felony work, misdemeanor work, and juvenile work. We have 55 counties where we're doing felony supervision, 75 counties where we do the intensive supervised release, and that's a description of parole, and 82 counties where we have alternative programming for state prisoners as well. And there's descriptions of all these programs available. So Department of Corrections also has broad oversight about the next two delivery systems, the Community Corrections Act, and folks will be testifying shortly about what the Community Corrections Act provides. 70% of probation parole services are satisfied under the Community Corrections Act, and those offenders are supervised. In addition to the Community Corrections Act, then we also have counties that are engaged in probation supervision, and the county work primarily deals with juvenile and misdemeanor work. When we talk about probation and parole, prison population enters into discussion because probation and parole really saves us in controlling prison populations. Many states are in crisis right now because they do not have robust probation parole systems. And I'll draw your attention to the bottom note here. Minnesota has the second lowest rate of prison incarceration of all 50 states. And that primarily is due to the fact that we do have a very robust probation and parole system. It's not that we have necessarily a low crime rate. These statistics show that, in fact, we're pretty average. But again, the greater reliance on community supervision and the less reliance on state prisons. And I was glad that there was mention of the Texas initiative on smart on crime that was mentioned earlier today. I think there's a recognition that tough on crime costs a lot of money. Building prisons certainly impacts state budgets. We did a little inquiry. Minnesota is 49th in the amount of money we spend on corrections. It's 2.7% of our general fund. Michigan spends 22% of the general fund on corrections. It is an incredible number, and we are very proud that we are 49th in the spending on corrections. It speaks highly to administrators of the past. 30 years ago, the implementation of community corrections and the sentencing guidelines really gave us the tools to control populations. I have greatly abbreviated my presentation because I know the folks behind me have some good stuff to tell you, and they are definitely the people, the vast majority of corrections. We currently have the 132,000. 70% of those are under supervision elsewhere. You have the PowerPoint in front of you. I'm going to defer my comments anymore to the next presenter. And that
Commissioner Roy?
Unless there are questions, Mr. Chair, I certainly can take some at this point in time.
Commissioner Roy, the only question I would have is the 49th in spending. Wouldn't that vary quite a bit depending? Are we comparing apples to apples in all cases, or would it vary on how that's calculated, in other words, per diems and this and that, the other thing, what we spend money on, what the other states spend money on? And
Mr. Chair, representatives, that statistic comes from the Pew Institute, nationally recognized. There, we believe that there isn't a finer research group in the country, and there is some detail about how they calculated those numbers in the appendix of those reports. I'll gladly make those available to Mr. Carger for distribution.
You will have a comment by our fiscal analyst, Mr. Carger, followed by Representative Grunhagen, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, you're right. The person is right from the Pew Institute, but also comes from the census information data. And I just want to point out one other thing that another representative reminded me of, that for total corrections spending along with judicial and police, Minnesota ranks 25th in the as far as spending is concerned. And per capita state and local expenditures for corrections, Minnesota ranks 34th. But like the commissioner said, Minnesota has the low per capita for prison cost at 49.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, I know some people work in the probation area, and one of their questions that I'm just passing on to you is, when a probation is revoked, there seems to be a certain percentage of the revocations where the person is sent back to a state prison rather than housed in a county facility. And in fact, this person who has worked in the probation area for numerous years said, we have a lot of our county jails statewide partially filled, and they're per diems at maybe $40 or $50 a day versus the state prison, which we're looking at per diem of $100 a day. And he specifically isolated non-violent offenders. Why are we sending them back to the state prison when we have plenty of room in our county jails and increasing our overall cost?
Commissioner Roy.
I do have a comment on that, and that's a very astute observation from that person. The hearings and release unit of Department of Corrections dictates the disposition of those violators. And there is a very comprehensive report that was just done last year, actually, that is examining who's going back and who is not going back. Speaking as a parole officer, it happens many times that person that is going back to the state institution has already experienced numerous supervision problems. So it's not just one event usually that returns them to prison. It's usually a series of events. And really the notion of the hearings and release unit is to find a local disposition for those violations if that person is not a community safety risk. Some of these guys certainly are risk when they violate. They've demonstrated their inability to conform. And but if we can find a community alternative, which includes local jails, local treatment, electronic supervision, all those things we hope will defer people from going back to prison. But I will also provide that report.
Representative Grunhagen.
This person has worked in the probation probably as long as I've known, probably 25 years. And he gave me a reason why it's being done. I'll share that with him privately afterwards. But he thinks there's a lot of nonviolent people who accept the state prisons, which could be housed in the county jail. To just reiterate that, and to the degree that you can help us save some money there, appreciate it.
Great. Very good.
Commissioner Roy, before you leave us, would you be willing to give your opinion on the possibility of a bill being formed where we would weld the tiered system into one, and would that be a expense neutral or savings? Just a general comment on what you think.
Mr. Chair.
And I'm going to ask that of each person that comes up. So,
there actually was some work done about 14 years ago. There was a committee put together through the court system, and it was entitled Joint Legislative Conference of Chief Judges Correctional Delivery System Study. And it was, that group found that it was very difficult to define the cost factors, and I would share their opinion that if in fact there is some consideration for a single delivery system, that it really needs a comprehensive cost analysis, cost benefit analysis. It is not a question that's easily answered. I would only hearken back to my previous comment that we're getting pretty good bang for the buck right now, and it would be certainly some efficiencies might be expected with the single delivery system, but I couldn't sit here today and honestly tell you that it would save money. It might be equal costs. There's labor considerations. There's melting of information systems, supervision strategies, all kinds of elements that may enter into that discussion.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. You have the next testifier?
Thank you very much for the time.
Appreciate it. Okay, folks, who would like to proceed first? Give me your name and title, and go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Carol Roberts, and I'm president of the Minnesota Association of Community Correction at Counties. In my my alternate life, I'm director of corrections for Ramsey County. Sitting on my right is Ryan Erdman, who is the executive director of MACAC, and on my left is Josh Milo, who is a member of the MACAC Executive Board and Director of Corrections for Blue Earth County. They're both here to help answer questions and to keep me out of trouble with this board. So what is MACAC? MACAC is an organization of correction directors from the CCA jurisdictions. Our mission is to serve as developing policy for our field, serving as a resource for other directors throughout this state, and generally supporting each other in the work that we do and sharing some of our resources. MACAC puts a very high premium on collaboration, and to that end, we work with very closely with the Department of Corrections, MACPO, and MCA. And we've recently started a new cooperative effort to look at the area of juvenile justice and put some emphasis in that area at this time in terms of looking at issues that were presented there and opportunities for change. So what is CCA, the Community Corrections Act? It dates back to 1973. And it allows counties to provide all community corrections services in the county. We do community supervision, that's probation and parole. You've heard the commissioner allude to that. We supervise adults and juveniles, all levels of crime. There are 32 counties that are involved in the Community Corrections Act, organized into 17 jurisdictions that participate in CCA. And here's an important part, though. We presently supervise up to somewhere between 72 and 73% of all the offenders that are on the street. 72 to 73%, all categories of offenders that are there, they are under our jurisdiction. We receive significant support from the state in terms of our Community Correction Act subsidy. And that is very helpful to us. Now, what about CCA? Why do we like it? One is why we think it's important is that there's local accountability. We all report to a community board or a board of some sort of citizens who live in the actual communities where we supervise offenders. community boards, community, the local community, the grassroots community. They want to know who's under supervision in this county, what is happening in this county, what are you doing about it? And we feel a very, very direct connection to our citizens, no doubt about it. And that's what we think is like really important about CCA. A number of us, like myself, who's a big city girl, actually lives in a first ring suburb of Ramsey County because I personally believe that I have to have a commitment to my constituents, to the people who live in that community, for what it is, the work that I do. Now, I'm going to sort of touch on some of the areas that the commissioner touched on. We think that community supervision is the most effective means of protecting public safety in this state. You've heard that Minnesota incarcerates at a much lower rate than almost anybody else in this country. But here's some other things that you should know. Just an example. Nothing tells it like an example. Our sister state next door to us, to the east, Wisconsin, basically the same kind of population, Minnesota, maybe a couple hundred thousand more, they incarcerate at twice the rate of Minnesota, but have and spend twice the amount of money that we spend in Minnesota. The last time I looked at statistics for Minnesota from the Department of Corrections, we were basically spending about $472 million on correctional services. They're spending $1.22 billion on correctional services. Now, I just had an opportunity a couple of months ago to attend a forum in Washington, D.C. on a federal grant, and Wisconsin was there, and the Wisconsin people, and you might have seen this in the Star Tribune, Wisconsin people were telling me, our legislature has told us we need to go to you to see what it is that you're doing because we're not getting any better crime results than you are. But we're spending a tremendous amount of money. Look at those figures. The numbers are the numbers. We're saving this state hundreds of millions of dollars because of that robust supervision system that the commissioner was talking about. Our work, the commissioner has given you some information about what kind of crimes we all have in this state, what the percentage is, and things like that. But what is this work that we do, and how is it that we do it? Our job is to help stop the next crime, and it's to create one less victim. Broadly speaking, that's what we're about. How do we do that? We assess the likelihood, and we're pretty good at this in this state, we assess the likelihood that an offender will commit a new crime. We do that using a bunch of instruments. If you want to know about that sort of detail inside baseball, we're glad to provide it to you. We then look, and we supervise them according to that risk. We then look at what are the risk factors for this individual, which if we don't do something about, is going to likely result in ongoing criminality. We then turn around and we work with that offender to address those risk factors. We want to, as a result of our presence, reduce the risk to the community in which they live. That's what we're about. We also have to help stabilize offenders. This is not necessarily related to recidivism, but we can't have people living under the bridge and supervise them there. That isn't just smart. That's not smart work. We all know that. But sometimes we have to help stabilize their situation so that we can work with them. The other thing that we do is we enforce the conditions of probation or supervised release that are provided to us by either the court or the Department of Corrections. Our challenges. You need to do the kind of work and what it is that we're expecting, because we're all about outcomes. We really do look at outcomes. To do that work, we need a smart, well-skilled staff, and the staff has got to have the time to deal with those offenders. And those two things can be great challenges, particularly in greater Minnesota, where there's not so much of an access to training, and even if training is, we share our training, somebody's got to be doing some driving in that picture. Also, it's the amount of time, again, in greater Minnesota, you may have a probation officer who has a lot of windshield time, between seeing somebody at this one end of the county to the other end of the county. That's all time, you know, that's not spent actually working with offenders. So it is a challenge for us. The other challenge is, and I suspect that this is throughout the delivery systems, the other challenge is having community partners that have the skills to do the kinds of work that we're expecting to get the kind of outcomes we want, because we're getting more and more reliance on data and evidence and what works and what doesn't, and holding people accountable to that. So it's not just a mom and pop shop who decides to open up, they're going to do good things for people. We're expecting real outcomes. And that's sometimes a challenge, to have people that have that skill set, or to have those programs at all. And in greater Minnesota, that is certainly a challenge, is to have access to the programming that will reduce offender risk. And so we're open for questions.
Thank you. And whenever we compared to another state, I'd like to have Mr. Carter comment. We made some comparisons to Wisconsin in this testimony. What are the problems or the goods or bads about comparing us to Wisconsin? You know, offhand, or on this subject?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's all good for Minnesota when we compare ourselves to Wisconsin. In fact, just a couple of years ago, I think Wisconsin had over 1,000 prisoners at our Appleton facility, and they do use prison a lot more than Minnesota, and they use probation services a lot less than Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. And Mr. Representative, we had a couple. Would you want to speak to that point?
I was
first?
Just going to make a quick comment. A number of the statistics we use comes from this document produced about 6 months ago called the Wisconsin Taxpayer. It's from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, their version of the Taxpayers League here in Minnesota. And the title is The Cost of Corrections, Wisconsin and Minnesota, and it's essentially all about how much less we spend. Some of the crime rate information that I could provide you would come from this report as well.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead and state your name.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Ryan Erdman, the Executive Director of MACAC.
Thank you. And then we had a couple of questions here. Representative Johnson, followed by Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about probation revocations, but I want to hear from the three delivery systems, I think, before I actually ask the question. I just want to make sure I'm on the list, because I know we're pretty tight on time. So whenever you think the time to ask that question would be, I'd appreciate a nod this way.
Thank you. And Representative Leidiger?
Well, my question, Mr. Chairman, was along the lines of these cost comparisons. Do we include, you know, the cost of the housing and everything else, I mean, when we make these comparisons? Because it's not only the direct costs of prison incarceration, things like that, but I mean, we have we do so much more. Do we include all that in the comparison model?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I think the panel was talking about were the numbers that are going to prison. And when you get into the cost, I mean, that's a factor. Remember, we talked about a little bit about before, because it's hard to determine a per diem and compare that per diem to one state to the next, because, you know, what's included in the per diem. But I think these are somewhat apples-to-apples comparisons, because you're talking about just the numbers that are going to prison on a per capita basis, so per 100,000. So I hope, does that help?
Well, I'm just thinking about, you know, Mr. Chairman, the costs of, to help stabilize an offender. You know, we have the housing costs and these, you know, everything on that one slide here about the work. Does that get included in the comparison model?
Mr. Gerger?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I do not think we have comparisons as far as probation costs amongst the states, and I don't, maybe the panel.
Mr. Chair.
Ma'am?
Mr. Carter, this is just the DOC costs we're talking about from state to state.
Okay. All right. Not, they, just to follow up, but they would also have probation costs over there, right?
Yes.
And then what are our probation costs?
Yes,
in comparison, or am I
missing the point.
Chair, Representative Leiter, yes, they would have those costs. It would probably be on a per cap, per person cost, because we have, again, it wouldn't be exactly the apples to apples. We have we have just the inverse of what they have. We have about 137,000 people under our supervision in the community. They have plus 5,000 supervised releasees. They have about half of that, 70 some odd thousand people. So, but there is a per capita, there is a per person cost that probably could be got.
Okay, so my point then being, we're probably paying one heck of a lot more in probation than what they are, and it'd be interesting to see what those figures are. I know we're making great savings on incarceration part of it, but it doesn't show the whole picture. I guess that's my point.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Leidiger, I would note that these are overall Department of Corrections budget comparisons, so that does include the funding that the Department of Corrections either uses for themselves or sends to Minnesota counties for the purposes of probation and supervised release. The one area that is left out of this equation is the county contribution. But in terms of the actual state contribution, it is at the department level, and the department's overall budget of $447 million annually includes those monies that are passed on to counties and that they used for probation and supervised release. So that community supervision cost is factored in that regard. Like I said, the county contribution in Minnesota is much higher than the county contribution in Wisconsin, and that's the one element of the comparison that is missing. But on a state dollar comparison, we are including community supervision costs when we make that comparison.
That helps.
We'd kind of like to move on here. If you had comments from one of you two folks that haven't said anything yet, we have a whole new, another group to bring up here yet.
I'm sorry.
But go ahead. You can folks can make a comment if you'd like, if they can miss anything or add.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leiter, I think one thing that we want to say that is a genuine rule that you can take to the bank, that it costs more to incarcerate a human being than it does to have them on probation supervision by many factors. I think that is something. Do we have the precise numbers here between Wisconsin and Minnesota? No. But generally, probation services are like under $10, and you're per person that's under supervision, way under 10, as opposed to $100 a day for a state institution. That's pretty standard in this country.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps Representative Johnson and I are on the same page, but I'd just like to question out there, because the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission has some numbers that suggest 15% of the prison population is probation revocations. But also in that report, the numbers, the comparison of revocation rates between counties is dramatic, from 30% down to 5%. I just wonder if you have any comments on why that discrepancy.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, again, it would be me hypothesizing with, maybe over 40 years of experience in this field. You have different ways. There's culture. There are culture issues in each place, how crime is viewed, how much is tolerated, how much misconduct is tolerated. You have different practices among probation officers, you have different practices, different points of view that a county board would have about issues, and different points of view that the bench, and sometimes it's a reflection of the tenor of the composition of the bench. There are a whole amalgam of factors about who people are and how they think about the world that goes into answering that equation. Some jurisdictions have thought very intentionally about how do we create a continuum, a way of looking at misconduct so we don't send everybody back. They're trying to develop other alternatives, and that's another issue. Alternatives, where do you send people? You can't have an either-or situation. If you have an either-or situation, more people are going to wind up in jail than they are in some sort of mid-range sanction in the community.
Okay. Oh, it's Jerry, we want to move on.
Mr. Milo, did you have any comments to make before?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, I think the one thing that I'd like to make is when we talk about the comparison among supervision in the community and institutions is that we do have a great number of people in the community, but our still our number one goal is public safety. And sometimes it might be looked upon as being less safe for the public and the community, but that is our goal, is to have no more victims and have one less victim. So we are holding people accountable, and there are times that revocation is necessary, and there's times, rest assured, that we'll feel good if somebody's incarcerated, because there are times that individuals that we're supervising shouldn't be on the street and shouldn't be in the public. But we want to continue to make sure that we supervise the majority in the community, and for those that really need to be incarcerated, those are the ones that should be locked up in our state institutions or our county jails.
Okay. Representative Johnson, did you want to try now?
I'll jump in now. Just to Representative Kelly's point, the replication rates are just so dramatic between some of the counties. It seems like that's something that the three delivery systems could, in fact, address in some fashion, differing from 30, 28, 27% of cases revoked to 2, 3, 4, and 5%. That seems... something that needs to be looked at and some answers given as to why, in fact, that is the case. I guess I'd like to, at some point, get some more information on that. And I'd also be curious as to, given the cost of, as has stated, it costs much more to incarcerate than supervise, would it make more sense to look at some kind of intensive supervision for those that are being revoked back to prison on occasion rather than send them back to prison? Has that been looked at as a possibility, as a cost-saving device given our economic times?
And Mr. Milo, do you want to answer? I didn't get your full name on the record yet.
So. Okay. Josh Milo, Director of Blue Earth County Community Corrections.
And if you could keep it kind of short, we got another testifier.
I mean, I think that is a good question to look at our community responses. And what we're looking at is our highest risk offenses and how can we give those services. And we also have to look at not just giving them intensive supervision, but addressing the risk and their needs when they're dealing with that. But I do agree that is something we do need to look at a state to make sure that the highest risk individuals are going back to prison or incarcerated. For an example, just recently in Blue Earth County, we incorporated a new high-risk caseload just for this reason, that we can look at the supervised release individuals and high-risk probation people. And one of our goals is that we shouldn't be asking for revocation to prison until they've gone through this high-risk caseload and they've been given services to address their risk and needs. So I agree that's something we do need to look at.
And we have a comment from Mr. Carter. Question.
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to point out that when you're looking at the institutional population, I think as Representative Kelly and Representative Johnson said, that probation violators make up 15.2% of that population. And I did a rough cost estimate here, and that's costing the state over $46 million a year, just using the estimates that their marginal, or not their marginal per diem, but their regular per diem. And as long as it's variances in revocation rates, this is an interesting report. It was done in 1996 by the legislative auditor, and they have a one chapter two, and the name or the title of this chapter is Variations in Minnesota Probation Services. Just for here.
Okay, thank you very much. How many testifiers do we have left here? We've got 7 minutes for three people. The poor guy here in the coming down here, it seems like we're going to have to start with you first one of these times. I think the last three times you had about a minute and a half. If you could say something that hasn't been said before, offer us a new testimony or your ideas here in a short period of time, thank you. Go ahead and state your name and...
Okay, I'll be quick. I'm Steve Peterson. I'm the current president of the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, or MACPO. Also, my regular day job is I'm the director of court services in Waseca County. And I guess I'm a representative of what's been thrown around as Greater Minnesota here.
Mm-hmm.
A couple things that I wanted to highlight quick before coming up here. I took a look, what is the history on probation in Minnesota? And I guess I didn't realize it goes all the way back to 1959 when Minnesota Department of Corrections was established. It was in 1961 that there was legislation, in 59 it established the three different systems, not community corrections, but there was three different systems, one of which is the county probation officer system. In 1961 is when they started to, the state started to subsidize the services that were being provided on a county level. And then in 1969 was actually the passage of the Community Corrections Act, but then the subsidy didn't come until 1973. I could, originally, if we had more time, I could read to you the statutory authority for county probation offices, but in respect to CalSARI, we'll move through it quickly, that you can look into Minnesota Statute 244.19 and see that county probation officers are established as appointments made by the local district court judge in consultation with county board. So it's not like we're acting alone as we're establishing county operations. We also have to consult with the Department of Corrections to ensure that the position is needed so that there already is a fair amount of collaboration to the whole system. The point that I guess I was most interested in making to you is that probation is probation. Because of the size of our county, I still have probation cases. I know what's going on in other counties. I won't profess to know what's going on across the state, but I do know that there's similarities, that probation officers are committed to the idea that we have to protect the community, and by in accomplishing that, we can use a number of different measures, which you've already heard about. The reason I can say that I think that on the probation officer level that there's a similarities is that we're all trained. We come from formal academic backgrounds that are similar. We're trained in in-service training. Sometimes we're spending time together. All systems, I believe, are looking at evidence-based practices, restorative justice practices, to incorporate them into the way that we practice our profession of being a probation officer. So the bottom line on that is that I think on the probation officer level, there's good consistency, there's good training, there's variations on the way it's provided, but that there's a commonality on the probation officer level.
We're down to a minute apiece for the other guys.
All right. One last thing, one quick last thing. There's 27 county probation office counties at this point in time. Sometimes people want to lump us as being greater Minnesota, but in fact, a number of our counties are in the surrounding metropolitan area. So that you have counties such as Carver, Wright, Sherburne counties, Isanti, Chicago. So it is not an outstate phenomenon particularly. So I'll
okay, thank you, sir, for your testimony. And Mr. Sari, the next time you appear on our list, we're going to put you first, no matter what the subject. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committees. I felt really honored to be asked by the presenters this morning to join them at the table to make this presentation, giving you a brief overview of the delivery system of probation and parole services in the state of Minnesota. Each one of these organizations that you've heard from today have their own advocacy groups. MACAC, of course, represents administrators providing the delivery system, but those administrators and their boards would include the county board members or their advisory boards that function with it, so they're coming from that level. Steve Peterson here and the group that he represents in MACPO, they really represent, as he said, rural Minnesota, the smaller counties in Minnesota with unique interests that are, you know, specific to counties of those size. The Minnesota Corrections Association, as he told you, is a large organization that goes all the way back to 1933, long before any of these organizations, and our membership contains all of these same members. I think all the presenters here today are probably current members of the Minnesota Corrections Association. So although we all have advocacy groups that are working on certain issues, we work together. And I'm pleased to say that we have the best of all of these organizations working with us in MCA. And we have various committees, including adult justice committees, juvenile justice committees, and the legislative committee that work to provide you the best information that we can on the issues that are there from year to year in providing the delivery system of probation and parole. We see our role as advocacy in some cases for certain types of legislation, for new effective policies to help us do our job better, and we see ourselves as being a resource for you to get good information on the services that are available there. Minnesota, throughout the nation, is looked at as one of the elite in providing correction services, and we ask you to keep that in mind and know that we're all available to you to provide information to you as those questions come up.
Thank you,
sir, for the opportunity.
And would you like to make a comment?
Chairman Cornish, committee, my name is Bruce Hagstrom. I am the legislative chair for Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. I can only briefly add that CPO counties are very much accountable to the local community. We are appointed by the judges. We serve at the pleasure of the courts. And because we are typically very small units, we're very nimble. We can institute change in policy in days, not months or years. So CPO really offers a very community-responsive probation service. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony, and thanks to the folks that helped to arrange this. It's been very informative, and appreciate your testimony. Members, it's time to end our session here, and tomorrow we're going to have Mr. Carter go over the governor's budget, of which there is a sizable cut for supervision?
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.